Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. I know you've been waiting for this conversation. I really have. This is how I get to talk to the Saker and find out what's really going on in U.S.-Russian relations. And needless to say, we have a great deal to talk about, including, Saker, your latest piece. So welcome to the Soleri Report, and tell us about the latest publication at Vineyard of the Saker.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. Last time I was basically warning again and again. I've been doing that for close to 4 years now. Russia is preparing for war, and this time a Russian diplomat said it in a very blunt way. And it's kind of what really concerns me is that I don't see that many people are paying attention to that in the West. I mean, the media seems to be dead set on not reporting about that or dismissing it if at all reported. And I think that that's extraordinarily dangerous, because we're talking about the country who fought World War II and for whom, you know, war is a very real thing. It's not an abstract Hollywood concept. They know what it is. They know how terrible it can be. And yet, over and over again, they're warning that the empire and Russia are on a collision course. I think a warning like that should be, you know, heeded very, very, with a great deal of concern, and yet there's nothing happening.
You know, what struck me was I was in Europe for 6 weeks, as you know, and there's remarkably little understanding of how serious this is, even in Europe. And you would think, I mean, Europe could literally be destroyed by such a war.
Oh, absolutely.
And yet the focus of the media was very much on the midterm elections. Now, I think the midterm elections, in fact, could affect what happens next with Trump and Putin meeting in Paris on the 11th. But go into a little bit more detail about what the Russian diplomat said and sort of how it relates to some of the warnings you've given over prior years.
Well, basically, he said very directly, I mean, I'm going to quote him here. It's my own translation. He declared at an official meeting, he said, quote, "Recently at a meeting, the United States stated that Russia is preparing for war. Yes, Russia is preparing for war. I can confirm it. We're preparing to defend our homeland, our territorial integrity, our principles, our values, our people. We're preparing for such a war. But there's a major difference between us and the United States. Linguistically, this difference is just in one word, in both Russian and English. Russia is preparing for war, while the United States is preparing a war." So we have two very crucial elements here. First of all, an accusation. And the accusation is that the U.S. is preparing to wage war. And then the warning, which is that Russia is actually preparing to fight. And if it were just rhetoric, you know, you could dismiss it. But the thing is you always look also at capabilities and what actually a nation state does. And the fact is that Russians have been preparing for war for at least, I would say, 3 to 4 years now, very, very actively. And, you know, the kind of measures, it's not just empty talk and, you know, promising to make Russia great again or something like this. They recreated what's called a tank army, which is a very heavy kind of combat force, which is directed now to the Western strategic direction. Just to give you an idea how different that is from the 1990s. In the 1990s, there were no division level or above units on the western side of Russia. Basically, it had all sorts of different units, mostly brigade and below. But basically, you could say that in terms of conventional capabilities, Russia was almost disarming the western strategic direction. Now you've got a First Guards tank army, which was something that was resurrected, that existed during the Cold War and World War II. That's a very heavy fighting tool. You don't develop that. It's very expensive to do that if you don't believe there's a real danger. And obviously they do believe there's a real danger. So it's not only that, you know, they talk about it, but they actually are preparing. They had, you know, large civil defense exercises. The banking sector was practicing how to function, you know, how to keep the money flowing in case of war. I mean, over and over and over, we see that they actually also are doing what they said they would do. And of course, there's this March 1st speech by Putin, which indicated that the U.S. is not out of reach, and that the U.S. Navy and Air Force and all of them are now, you know, Russia's preparing to fight them. So it's very consistent. And it's not just one guy who's mouthing off because he's in a bad mood and he wants to say something tough. It's just very, very consistent message coming out of Moscow.
So we just, I think we're still in the NATO exercises in Norway. And again, there's been surprisingly little media about what's going on. Maybe if you could touch on what's going on with the NATO exercises and how it may dovetail with this.
Well, here you have to really separate the political and military level, because pretty much all the, I would call them the body movements of the United States or the empire, are highly provocative from a political point of view. And that includes deploying anti-ballistic missiles in Eastern Europe. It's the big exercise that has been conducted now in Northern Europe by NATO. It's, you know, sending ships inside the Black Sea, etc. These are very provocative on a political level, but actually militarily they don't mean much. I think it's large an exercise in, I really do believe it's basically psychotherapy, because I think Western politicians are trying to create an environment of tension, and then they're trying to prove, to show by their actions that they're serious about it. But if you look at what they're actually doing, this is not a military real threat to Russia. I mean, yes, right, these units are very close to Russia. It's the same thing as the NATO forces in Poland or in the Baltics. Yes, they are within, you know, minutes of striking major Russian cities. But in military terms, if you're looking at an actual conflict in Europe, the kind of threat presented by these forces is pretty small, actually. So it's much more dangerous. What the West is doing is huffing and puffing, pretending like there's no risk of war, but at the same time, the actual capabilities developed are not commensurate with what it would take to prepare for a conventional war in Europe. So it's a lot of hot air and provocative hot air, which is met on the other side by angry resolve, and it's not just hot air, it's actually capabilities.
So we saw Mattis about 2 weeks ago announce that the U.S. needed offensive space weapons. Now, I clearly believe they already have offensive space weapons, but how does that fit in?
Again, we had Mattis saying that, and before that we had Trump speaking about creating space forces. It's a lot and a lot of rhetoric. And the rhetoric is very bellicose. I'm not sure that this is militarily significant, because in reality, to develop that kind of capability, it would take years. It's major means. I mean, it's not something you do overnight. But particularly if you're preparing to tackle an enemy as large as NATO for Russia or Russia for NATO, this is something that, you know, you don't just make a political speech and change course.
Well, the question is, have they been doing it for the last 20 years through the black budget? There's certainly been enough money going into the black budget to do some pretty significant things. The question is, where's the money been going?
And that I don't know. I can't answer that.
Right.
Possibly they have. Possibly they've just, you know, made the money disappear and bought themselves yachts for it. I don't know.
Right. No, it's too much money for yachts. I mean, it's just... It's there are not enough yachts in the world to use up.
Yeah, I meant that metaphorically. I mean, obviously.
Right. We've certainly spent plenty on yachts. There's no doubt about that. Okay, so we see Trump as part of the election. Well, we see two things very notable in the election. One is the Democratic strategy of tying the Trump campaign to Russia has failed completely. And the only thing it's managed to do is illuminate the fact that the Democrats tried to falsely frame a case. You know, they tried to basically create such a case. And, you know, so I would say the whole Mueller strategy has fallen flat on its face, not to say it hasn't used up a lot of time and money and made a mess. But the other thing we've seen is Trump, and who knows how, you know, whether this just dies after the election or not, threatened to withdraw from the INF treaty. So explain what the INF treaty is, what it means, and what a withdrawal would mean.
What it is, it's a treaty concluded during the Cold War, which basically removes missiles, land-based missiles, not air or sea-based, that are short to medium range in their capabilities. It's the Pershing versus, you know, SS-20, that treaty that was signed between the USSR and the United States. I will tell you again, this again is one of those things which I think is very important politically. I am more dubious about it militarily. Because frankly, that treaty was not very good for the Soviet Union and is not good for Russia. It has a lot of problems in it, the way it was calculated, the way some systems were ignored. Others, Russia included, pretty capable systems, which were, didn't have to be there, but they volunteered to destroy them. Actually, I'm surprised that anybody in the West would want to get rid of that treaty, because I find it more to the advantage of the West to keep it. So again, I think this is more, I don't think there's a real strategy behind that. I think that the U.S. is now on a long spree of abrogating treaties, withdrawing from international agreements, withdrawing from international bodies. I see that as a typical sign of weakness, where essentially what you do, you say, well, okay, we're unable to negotiate anything for a number of reasons, ranging from the fact that we're, you know, any negotiation or discussion with Russia is assimilated to a treason or being, you know, a Putin agent, to the fact that our diplomats are incompetent and are unable to negotiate meaningfully, which has been going on at least since Obama. So at the end of the day, when you don't have the ability to conduct meaningful diplomacy and you don't have the military to really fight everybody that you would like to fight, you end up making unilateral decisions which sound, you know, tough. I withdraw from the INF treaty, therefore I'm tough on defense. That's actually nonsense. You're not tough on defense by withdrawing from treaties that are to your advantage. And yes, that's what Trump is doing. So I think this is more, frankly, hot air, as most of what's coming in terms of pretend policy, I would call it, from the West is hot air. There's not much substance here.
Well, what it looks like to me is that, you know, it's when you run a business and you're trying to bring up new systems, you try and keep the old systems going and run them parallel until the new system is ready to kick in. So if you look at what Trump and the people who put him in power are doing, they seem to be reshoring, rebuilding into North America so that they can, you know, survive. They pull back inside the oceans, project power with drones and satellites, et cetera, and get ready to shift to a multipolar world. But in the meantime, they're going to do everything they can to keep the empire and the reserve currency and the economics of the existing system going. So it's a little bit like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time. You know, it's a shell and pee game in the meantime.
I guess I'm more critical and cynical about that. To me, it's more of a case of, with somebody with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The one thing that they're good at in Washington is declaring sanctions, withdrawing from treaties and international bodies, and making unilateralist roaring statements about becoming great and, you know, showing the world. That's not really a policy. I don't see that they're preparing for a multilateral world. In military terms, what is being done right now just makes absolutely no sense to me. I think we're dealing with basically the empire is coming down pretty fast. And the fact that it basically is on a confrontation course with most of the planet is really a very, should be a worrisome sign for those who like the unilateral world hegemonic order. And I think it's falling apart everywhere.
Well, it's almost as though people are locked into their model and they can't envision a way of migrating to a new model. You know, they need the margins this quarter. And let me just play devil's advocate here, just for the sake of fleshing this out. Let's say, you know, the military spending is now overtly up to $2 trillion a year globally. And you have the entire military-industrial complex that, you know, I believe engineered 9/11, basically needing to keep the game going. And you can't keep the game going unless you have enemies. So Russia and China need to be the enemies of the U.S., and you need to, you know, rattle the drumbeats of war so everybody buys weapons. Now, the U.S. is the number one exporter of weapons in the world, and Russia's number two. So they both have a vested interest in sort of keeping the game going, and the pressure from the military-industrial complex to keep the game going is absolutely enormous. So, you know, it's almost as though everybody makes money from almost having a war, but not having a war. To what extent is this simply a dance that's orchestrated for everybody to keep the game going?
You know, we can second guess that. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable thesis. But the military-industrial complex under Reagan was also very powerful, and yet they did go for agreements. The U.S. military was very powerful at that time. The Joint Chiefs were, you know, playing a major political role, and yet they figured out that they did not want to go on a collision course with the Soviet Union, even though it was a fairly weak Soviet Union then. So I think I don't see where you see plan and a policy. I see a lack of plan and a lack of policy, because first of all, you don't want to fight on so many fronts at the same time with so many possible risks. I mean, right. The very same day or the day after the Russian diplomat spoke, there was a speech by Xi Jinping in China who told his military, prepare for war against the U.S. But this is not something that, even if you want to run your military-industrial complex and continue to spending billions and trillions of dollars on quote-unquote defense, you don't want a situation where you might have actually a shooting conflict with Russia and China at the same time. And not to mention very severe political problems in the Middle East, which the U.S. largely created almost ex nihilo. I mean, the things were bad, but they weren't that right. bad. Now they're apocalyptically bad. I really don't have a sense, you know, that there's a plan behind that. What I see is the Titanic sinking and the orchestra playing louder and louder. And the orchestra includes the media and the politicians who seem to be stuck in completely empty rhetoric. That inability to actually tackle the issues at hand is, to me, the telltale sign of a lack of a plan. There is no real plan. I mean, if let's use your hypothesis, say it is a way of keeping, you know, almost a war and the military budget's running. Okay, but down the road, you end up with what? You end up either by having to fold or a military conflict that you can't afford. These are not good outcomes.
Right. I mean, ideally, what you do is you have the drumbeats of war continually. You get North America to the point where you can project power through space or robotics, and you know, you're able to weather. I mean, you're energy self-sufficient, you're food self-sufficient. If you can get manufacturing self-sufficient, your water self-sufficient. You know, if you can project power, you can sort of gut your way through the shift to the multipolar world from North America, especially if you make it the offshore haven for oligarchs around the world, which just looks to me like they're engineering, you know, so you make U.S. the offshore haven of choice. So, you know, as part of the Anglo-American alliance. So, you know, it looks to me like they're certainly getting ready for a difficult shift. But, you know, there's no doubt they're also trying to keep the empire going. And what they're doing to try and keep the empire going is, you know, you just shake your head and say, where's the beef? Let me step back and go back to what happened right after 9/11. You know, there was a plan to occupy and basically bring into obedience 7 countries in 5 years. And, you know, if you look at the Bush administration projections of how much it would cost, you know, I think it's at this point about 5% of what it's cost so far. You know, and if you look at that plan, which was really to assert hegemony along the Silk Road, I would say that that plan has failed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely agree with you. That plan has failed. And furthermore, you mentioned power projection, but I don't think the U.S. has that ability to project power. I don't believe that drones or pushing more militarization of space will solve the problem. I think the problem of the U.S. military is that basically it has for years developed in a direction which makes it now close to useless for the U.S. politicians. I mean, there's very few military missions that the U.S. can accomplish successfully. And keep in mind that just flying somewhere and bombing a place is not a success. It should be a means towards the goal. But the problem is that that means doesn't work. And you look at the countries that have been subverted since 9/11, and every single time it's a catastrophe. It makes things worse and worse and worse. So I think that is the real big problem and the big secret that they're trying to hide is that they're, you know, I used to say that the dollar used to be protected by, you know, gold, then it used to be backed by petrodollars and oil, and then it was backed by aircraft carriers. Well, now it's not even backed by aircraft carriers because the aircraft carriers can't get the job done. And you see that by the fact that no countries are willing to be actually successfully bullied into submission. That okay. loss of military power is absolutely crucial because that was always in the back. Every time the U.S. engaged in a dangerous policy, there always was this idea in the back of the mind of most politicians that, well, if it fails, we'll bomb the shit out of them. You know, that's the concept. For instance, the perfect example of that is as Desert Shield, when they send the 82nd Airborne against the Iraqi yeah. Armored Corps. There was, of course, the question of what happens if the Iraqis cross the border and the 82nd, which is light infantry, is confronted by a much larger armored force. And the idea was, okay, well, we try tactical air, and if that doesn't work, we go for tactical nuclear weapons. So there's always this, there was always this safety belt, if you want, this parachute. Well, if our policy fails, we'll always be able to just hammer somebody into the middle, into the Stone Age. Well, that doesn't work anymore. Nobody's afraid of that. And the U.S. gets slowly but continuously challenged militarily everywhere. That's a loss of capability.
Right. So I agree with you on the conventional side. It's just that over the last 15 years, every time that the dollar should have really cracked down in value, something happens. A lot of times it's a natural disaster. So I don't know if you've ever heard my story about the Indonesian tsunami. Mm-mm. But if, you know, I watched massive insider trading a week before the tsunami, mm-hmm. and I couldn't understand what was happening or why. And then the tsunami happened and I realized, oh, they knew. And if you look at some of the trading or economic patterns immediately after the tsunami, they were clearly, you know, indicative of an induced tsunami. So I have seen too many unconventional, you know, whether it's tsunamis or hurricanes or other covert things that suddenly shift the market from where it should be. And so it tells me that there are plenty of covert wars going on. I don't understand them. I don't have the evidence to prove them, but I've seen it happen enough over the last 15 years that I know it's real because, frankly, you know, the Americans don't want a war with Russia. What they want is to control Russia, and mm-hmm. they want to control Russia economically. And so the goal is not to have a war. The goal is to squeeze Russia the way they squeeze Germany and Japan, you know, and pretty much everybody else. And that's what this is about. It's a little bit like, I'll never forget talking to an activist once who was violently opposed to gun ownership. And I said, I guess you don't want your Social Security. And they said, that has nothing to do with it. And I said, I guess you don't understand the role of weapons in terms of control. It's about, you know, it's about money, a lot of this fight. So I don't think America wants war. I think America wants to be able to squeeze economically, and that's what this is about. And that's why, you know, indirectly the general population supports the policies more than they, you know, they want to face or admit, because everybody wants their check.
Okay, but let me answer this in the following manner. First of all, I've never seen any evidence of functioning deployed seismic or climatological weapons, but let's even assume that they exist. A couple of points here. First of all, you can try that at created tsunami for economic reasons, but to actually try something like that against a country like Russia would be suicidal, because the Russians would obviously interpret any of such use as basically similar, basically putting using a weapon of mass destruction, you know, attacking Russia on a strategic level. So you're exposing yourself to nuclear retaliation. Right. So even if that was the case, I don't think you can substitute real military capabilities with that kind of technologies. Then you say that the problem with Russia is that they want to subdue it economically. I think it's part of it, but I don't think Russia is the major threat from Russia is an economic one. I think the major threat from Russia is a civilizational one. What Russia is doing right nowadays is offering a completely different civilizational model, which challenges some of the core values and beliefs of the empire, of the ideology of the empire. One of them, for instance, being that Russia is very stubbornly insisting that countries should deal with each other on the basis of complete equality, and by means of international treaties and organizations, which, you know, is a multipolar world, which is something the empire doesn't want. And I think coming back to the danger of the weapon of the capabilities issue is that I agree with you that they don't necessarily want a full nuclear war that would be devastating for both countries. But I also think that they believe that should it come to that, the Russians wouldn't dare, because axiomatically, by definition, dogmatically, the U.S. is number one. We're the biggest, most powerful. You know, we have such, we're spending, always the argument is, look how much the U.S. is spending on defense, how much Russia is spending on defense. It's so much bigger than the U.S. Therefore, we have the biggest capability. Well, in military terms, it's actually not true. So here's the danger, is what you think that you're protected and the enemy cannot fight back, and yet the enemy actually can. At that point, the game of chicken becomes very dangerous. And when the warnings from the Russian side are being ignored the way they are right now, it's even more dangerous. The Russians are trying desperately to convey to the United States and the people in the West that, guys, we won't retreat any further. And if you do cross the, you know, our fundamental strategic line, we will fight back.
So let me tell you why this issue of values is so important in culture. Because the West trumpets the notion that it's Christian, and it trumpets Christians' values. But what the Russians are proposing is real Christian values. And so there's a, you know, you have a problem outspinning the Russians on the values issue, you know, which is why Putin's Christmas speech a few years ago claiming the pedophilia in the West was so important. Because this is really coming down, and that's why you also had a piece on the Russian Orthodox Church and the empire trying to split the church. Maybe you could describe that.
Well, I think that's another one of those cases where I don't think the empire is realizing what it's doing. Basically, it used, just as an introductory comment, the Orthodox world is not, for those who don't know it, it's not an Eastern Rite version of the Western papacy. There's no centralized administration, which is the Orthodox churches have their unity coming from their common faith, but administratively they're all independent. And what happened basically is the West is trying to engineer, basically to split the Orthodox world into two groups. One would be headed by the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, who is basically claiming an authority very similar to the one that the Pope has in the Latin Church. And those countries who would, those churches, should I say, that would not accept that, that kind of prerogatives for him, would be basically lining themselves up behind the Moscow Patriarchate. I think that's what's taking place today. And that's going to have a major impact because it basically forces every single Orthodox church, bishop, priest, parish, and even every single Orthodox individual layperson to ask the question, which of the two is right, which of the two is Orthodox? Because in the Orthodox Church, you don't have a teaching church and a taught church. Every single Orthodox Christian was responsible for maintaining the tradition and basically the what you call the ecclesiology of the original church, which means that, you know, in the 11th century, Rome said, we're going to run, one man can run the entire church, basically, and that created the schism between the Rome and the rest of the Christian world. We're having almost the same thing happening right now. I don't think it's going to reach the same proportion, but fundamentally it raises the same issues. And that's not going to go unnoticed in the Orthodox world. That's a very traumatic and a very important topic for the Orthodox. Does one person have the right to rule the church in the name of God, yes or no? The answer has been for 2,000 years, no. And I don't see that changing today. So it's going to create a major crisis inside the Ukraine because we already see attempts at redefining who the legitimate Ukrainian Orthodox Church is. And what we're looking at, some people speak of civil war. I don't think so, but I think we're looking at a repeat of massacres like what took place in Odessa. There's a very real risk that this is going to happen in specific cathedrals and monasteries and very historical churches, which are going to become the they're going to become the place of seizures by the regime of the churches currently belonging to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, there's no doubt the empire continually sees chaos as in their best interests. And, there's a point, though, at which the chaos gets so great that it can't possibly be in anybody's interest.
Absolutely.
That's right, that's the challenge. So let's go back to the American leadership and how they got themselves in this box and how they might get themselves out of this box. Because, you know, one of the things, I basically stepped outside the establishment in the mid-90s. And one of the reasons I did that, I was offered an opportunity to settle in 1998 and declined, was what I saw in their plans to globalize and their basically significant ramp-ups of the black budget was I thought they were on a trajectory that would fail. I just thought, you know, this is a losing bet, and I don't want any part of it. And I would rather work on, you know, I'd rather be in the wilderness working on alternatives. And I don't know if I ever told you this story. There was one moment when somebody asked me if I would join the Council on Foreign Relations, and I didn't want to do it for a variety of reasons, and I said, you know, I just don't want to do that. And he looked at me, he's a wonderful guy, and he said, you don't understand, if you do this, you're out forever. And just at that moment, I had an image of them taking my number and name off my underground base locker, and I realized, oh, you know, if it came to that, would I want to be underground with the Council on Foreign Relations or above ground with the general population? I said, I'd rather be above ground. So I don't, you know, whether it's the culture or the plan, you know, I don't think, you know, one, I don't think it's going to work, and two, it's not something I'm on board for, so it doesn't reflect my values. The question is how it seems to me that the American elites have lost their mind. Now, my experience with the elites are not so much with the Clintons or the, you know, the lower levels of the Bushes. It's the people at the top who are quite strategic and thinking and quite coherent and very, very intelligent. So now what they'll tell you is they're managing an irrational population, including, you know, people like the Clintons, and they just get wildly frustrated with everybody. But the question is, how in the world did the Western elites talk themselves into this mess?
Well, I can offer a hypothesis that I observed to some degree. Now, I've been far away from the elites for a long, long while, but I've been around elites in the 90s for sure. And I think there are a couple of things that happened simultaneously. I think, first of all, the ideology. I think ideology is extremely toxic. It's a very dangerous thing, because if you start stating something for ideological reasons, you then have to act within that these parameters. Because if you say A and you act non-A, eventually it comes out. So you have to act on what you're doing. That was actually true right. for Hitler during World War II. The Soviet Union, they had to do absolutely crazy things for ideological reasons. And I think it's also, I don't think the level of ideological intensity is any lesser here than it was in Nazi Germany or Soviet Union. I think we're living in a highly ideologized, I don't know if that's English, but I'll go with it, ideologized society where ideology plays a prime role and forces people for conformity reasons to engage in stupid behavior, including the people that you say are very intelligent and agree with you and they're aware of what's going on. But see, what happens is in an ideological society, to speak up and speak up from a point of view of common sense is political suicide and a career-ending action. And that right. is something that we clearly saw in other empires, and we see it very, very, very clearly today. I mean, for instance, I will never forget that during the campaign, at one moment Trump starts declaring that the U.S. military is in trouble and has problems, you know, and he was instantly accused by Hillary of being non-patriotic. See, that's the kind of dynamic which is extraordinarily dangerous. Somebody brings up a problem and he's beat over instantly by you know, the patriotic thing is to do what? Is to state dogmatically, never mind the facts and the evidence, that we have no problems. We have the best and strongest military. And you do that, right. and then you have to act on it. You can't say that and then do something opposite. So I think that's what happens. And then finally, a lot of people leave. I've seen that. I've seen that in Europe. You know, very good and competent people who sense that new ideological twist, and they just leave in disgust. And I think that the way the neocons seized power in the U.S. really changed the kind of people who are in power.
Oh, right. The shedding of the competent has been phenomenal.
Phenomenal, absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to say that these are my ideal people in terms of morality and ethics, but when I remember the quality of the people that you had around Reagan, for instance, or Bush 1, and you look at the diplomats or the military commanders today, I mean, there's a huge generational change between them and what we see today. And these people right. then were also, you know, empire defenders, no doubt about it, but they were intelligent, they were competent. And for one thing, to me, the ultimate proof is under Bush 1 and under Reagan, diplomacy played a major role. Right. Today, it doesn't exist. There's no such thing as U.S. diplomacy today. All it is basically right. more sanctions, more withdrawing from treaties, more sanctions, more withdrawing from treaties, more saber rattling. That's it.
Right. And the danger is the reason the U.S. dollar is so dangerous and dominant is because it provides massive liquidity. You've got a lot of most players still deeply vested in it. But that liquidity is the basis of its dominance, and the, you know, military as well. But liquidity, you've got a whole system dependent on that liquidity. Every time you use the sanctions, it's another nail in the coffin of the U.S. dollar liquidity, because you are basically saying these, you know, these systems are not financial, they're political.
Yes.
And we reserve the right to pull the rug out from under you if you irritate us in any way.
Yeah, and Putin said that openly.
So this decision on Iran and SWIFT is a very, very, you know, it's smart short run, it's suicidal long run.
Absolutely. And look, Mitch, the SWIFT is a perfect example of that. Look who's talking about replacing it now, the Europeans. It's not even Iran or Russia. It's the Europeans who are saying, you know, we need to find another way because this one is not trustworthy. And Putin openly said that he said he's marveling at the fact that they're destroying their own power base.
Right. And the Russians are building a SWIFT alternative.
Yes, they already have it. Inside Russia, right. They already have it. And I think it interfaces with the Chinese system. And they're constantly, you know, look what happened to Saddam Hussein, what happened to Gaddafi. And now we have countries where, you know, switching over to their own currencies for even for energy purchases, for trade, et cetera. There are all sorts of schemes going out there. They're all slowly, they're not really what Russia and China did is not so much, you know, step in and try to destroy the Western controlled system. Instead, they start building a parallel one right next to it.
Right.
And the fact is, there's nothing the U.S. can do to stop them.
Although I have to tell you, the Chinese are helping the Americans, because if you look at the things they do that indicate, you know, they are also untrustworthy. I would never trust the Chinese system, at least now. I'd trust the Russian system much more than the Chinese.
I wouldn't trust anybody. I think trust is just not a category that's used for, you know, superpower relationships. And that's why Russia and China don't have a formal alliance. I think they're having actually a strategic partnership and complete symbiosis. But that symbiosis is clearly what you call situational alliance.
Fractal. Yeah, it's fractal.
Absolutely.
It's one thing at a time. Russia, we see, just announced major purchases of gold in the last 3 months. Now, they've been purchasing gold since the mid-2000s.
Yep.
But they're, you know, they're clearly reducing their treasury and dollar positions and significantly increasing gold.
Yeah.
So they're planning on weathering the storm. Now, I will tell you, there is one fact that to me most undergirds your argument that Russia is preparing for war, and that is the pension fund reform. For someone with Putin's approval ratings and, you know, sort of past promises on pension, to stand up and change the retirement age and propose a reform package that would significantly hurt his approval ratings would only be done if he needed the money for military. In other words, he feels it's more important to protect the lives of all Russians than it is to keep the pension fund promises. So tell us a little bit about pension fund reform and what you think is happening there.
Oh, that's a complicated topic, and it's controversial, because I agree with you that, first of all, Putin traditionally was opposed to that kind of reform, and it did hurt him in the polls, absolutely. He actually sort of moved in. The idea was, of course, to raise, you know, to spend less money to make people work longer, and the problem is that the unemployment benefits in Russia are very small, so they would have to be. There's a lot of economic arguments whether it is a good or bad idea. I'm personally unconvinced. I don't think it was the right thing to do, but I'm not a specialist of that. But I will say that politically, it definitely did hurt him. The most significant result from that move, I think, was that the nature of the opposition has fairly dramatically changed in Russia. It used to be that you had a tiny little pro-Western party with a number of parties which were irrelevant, and that still is true today. But now you have the court parties, you know, those who were in the Duma, who were sort of kind of pretend opposition, but didn't put much, you know, efforts into really opposing, actually this time did some real protest, and there was some debate. And I think what happened is that there is now a patriotic opposition to specific plans, not to Putin as a person, to his economic course and specific actions of the government, which I think is coming now from much more credible, patriotic, not pro-Western sources, were also critical. So it did hurt him to some degree. There is the one hypothesis, and I mentioned other people in Russia said that. I have no elements to prove that, that the liberal government did that in order to try to weaken Putin. That's possible, but if that was the plan, it failed because he didn't lose that much. He right. proposed certain amendments which, you know, made it a little bit more palatable. So he weathered the storm, if that was the thing behind it. The pension reform has been passed. People don't like it, but it hasn't been the apocalypse that it could have been. But it has been a real warning shot that even Putin's credibility in Russia is not infinite. He has a lot of street cred. He still is very popular, but people can be critically patriotic, which is very new, and I think it's actually very helpful.
Well, here's the interesting thing. If you look at the history of pension funds over the last 20 years, there are very few countries that sort of teed up the boomer problems and addressed them head on. One of the sterling sort of examples of that is the Netherlands. And, you know, it needless to say, if you look at the people who did it, it was a very courageous and difficult thing that they did. It takes a lot of oomph in this environment to do the responsible thing on those issues of financial responsibility. You know, everybody wants their check. So,
yeah.
You know, if anything, it speaks highly of the Russians that they were willing to tee up and deal with it. And what it shows you is the weakness of the West, because if you look at what's going on in pension funds, everybody keeps kicking the can and not addressing it. And the fear in the West and the Western leaders is enormous, because after a financial coup d'etat, you know, if you're willing to gift the banks $24 trillion, if you're willing for $21 trillion to go missing from the federal government and enormous amounts of other fraud, but you don't have $5 trillion to fund the, you know, the underfunding of the pension funds, you know, how are you going to explain that?
But I'm not sure that the economic realities in the West are fully transferable to Russia. Again, I'm not an economist, but I've read right. some very reputable ones who say that this is, for instance, they bring up the issue of unemployment. If you have a country with strong unemployment protection, then it's fine to increase the retirement age. But if you have a country that doesn't have that, you're basically condemning, at least taking the risk of condemning people to complete misery. So how are you going to compensate right. for that? And if you will, is the money going to go out of the pension fund to then go into the unemployment fund, which is, you know, dubious at best?
Well, that's what we've done here with Social Security. We've enabled, you know, we integrated the funds. We allowed disability to tap it. And essentially where I live, disability is not really for disability. It's for unemployment, long-term unemployment.
Right. And remember that in Russia, and Putin said it in speeches, and I believe it's even, I'm not sure here, but I think it says that in the Constitution even. Russia is a social state, meaning that while in the West there is this idea that you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, the state is not here to provide, to protect you, but the private sector should do it, etc. In Russia, that's not the case. The state has an obligation, a political and moral societal obligation to help the poor, the weak, the sick, etc.
Right.
And what the Medvedev government is doing is moving away from that. Now, that has been done successfully in Europe, where, you know, former policies of France and Germany have been completely eviscerated, the social policies. But I think in Russia, there is much less of a ability to do that because the political culture is not accepting of this.
So the sanctions, tell us how the Russian economy is doing and what the sanctions have done to Russia.
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, it ranges from certain sectors who were definitely hurt by the sanctions and others who actually benefited immensely. I mean, recently there was a public meeting with Putin, I think it was in the Valdai, and one farmer said that their biggest fear is that they would, you know, what do we do if the sanctions are removed? I think Russia has adapted to the new regime of sanctions. I think Russia is preparing for even more sanctions. It has been a very painful It took a couple of years to do that, but I think they negotiated that successfully. I think the sanctions right now, basically, the Russians have come to terms that the way to deal with those sanctions is not to expect them to be lifted, and to restructure the economy and foreign policy in a way that takes care and, you know, takes in full consideration that new environment. I think the sanctions have completely failed.
Right. When I was in Switzerland, I had dinner with one gentleman who just come back from Moscow, and he said the food was fantastic. He's somebody who's traveled in America. He said it's wonderful to be in a place where, you know, there's no GMO. You don't have to even think or worry about it.
Yeah, but remember, Moscow is kind of a different planet. It's an extremely wealthy city. It's a huge city. No, there have definitely been people hurt by sanctions, and it has put a break on growth. I mean, to redirect the economy in a different direction is something that is always difficult and painful to do. So I think there's definitely people have suffered from it, and it's not over. It will continue, and I think it's just going to get worse.
Now, a few more topics I wanted to bring up. We just had a meeting of Putin, Merkel, Erdogan over Syria. The U.S. not invited, Britain not invited. What was the meeting and what happened?
Oh, that's very controversial, because we probably don't know what the most interesting part of the meeting were. The meeting was, yes, the absence of the U.S., but also the absence of Iran, which is not insignificant. And there's been a lot of debate whether this meeting was successful or not, because it didn't produce anything that could be, you know, claimed as a major success. And some observers said it basically was a failure because the positions of the different countries were too far apart. I don't agree with that. I think the meeting was very useful. And the fact that now the German and the French have basically been pulled into the diplomatic environment of Russia and Turkey and basically Iran, because if Iran wasn't present at the table, Iran certainly was present, you know, as an invisible and key actor to that group of countries. And yes, the U.S. and the U.K. are just absent from it. And that by itself is extremely significant.
So one of the things we heard when Trump pulled us out of the Iran deal was the Iranians implying that the Western leaders had received kickbacks when the deal went down and they wanted their money back. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
Okay. I don't know why. My intuition is, if you look at Kerry running over to Iran and trying to clean things up after Trump canceled the Iran deal, it was unprecedented to have a former Secretary of State do that. And it made me, you know, intuition said to me, I think this is probably true, but we'll put that aside. So when I was in Europe, I was in Bavaria, and Merkel, after a disastrous result in the elections, they're bowed out. Now, the reality is, if you look at who Merkel's allies in this country have been, if the Democrats, you know, if the Republicans sweep the House and the Senate today, I think Merkel is really, you know, it's going to make her life even more difficult. So it doesn't surprise me. But what do you think the impact is going to be on the EU of having Merkel out of the picture?
I'm not sure there's going to be that much of an impact, because Merkel, you know, she's a figurehead, a symbol of a completely failed European policy on so many levels. But there is no viable alternative yet. I mean, in theory, there's an obvious alternative, which is the nationalist far-right parties in Europe I'm not saying I'm necessarily endorsing them, but I'm saying that they represent at least a rhetorical change in course. But I don't think that these parties are capable of really replacing the entire European establishment, which is where the problem is. Europe has a political establishment which is rotten to the core, unable to formulate, and even less so defend, any kind of truly European or a policy favoring the countries of Europe. So Europe is basically decapitated. And, you know, will the French wave? One theory was that Macron would become the main guy in Europe, because obviously not the Brits, and now the Germans are in
the
crisis.
That's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen either. I agree with you completely.
Right. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Okay, so today is the election. It's Tuesday. There's a big question as to, clearly the Republicans are likely to win the Senate. the House race, the polls show a toss-up. I think the Republicans will probably eke it out. They'll probably eke out the governorship. They now have five people on the Supreme Court. So we're either going to wake up tomorrow with a Republican sweep or the Democrats getting the House. That's a possibility. We don't know which way it's going to go. My bet is the Republicans are going to sweep it. You know, you'll see something a little bit like 2016. But what if the Democrats do get the House, what is that going to mean for the U.S. relationship with Russia?
Again, that's sort of the theme today, but I'm not sure it's going to mean much. Because I don't see much to a part difference between, I think it's a uniparty that's, you know, the Republic, what is it, the Republicrats versus a Demo or whatever.
Right.
The elites that control this country are not, they don't change depending on the election. And I don't see, again, the same thing as in Europe. I don't see any kind of viable alternative. I don't see any third movement, any kind of outsider that could, you know, offer something different. I think we're going to see more of the same, only worse. And that's true for Europe and it's true for the U.S.
I'm going to ask you the same question we've talked about many times before, which is, you know, if we do go to war, I mean, you understand as, I mean, you're a military analyst. You understand the implications of war, I think, better than almost anybody who joins us on the Soleri Report. If we do go to war, what we're talking about is mutually assured destruction.
Certainly, yes. If it's a full-scale war, absolutely. But there could be other stages, which would be, I think, of tremendous surprise to the United States. I think that the one most ignored one is that Russia can strike the continental United States with conventional weapons. I think that's a huge difference with the Cold War, where the Soviet Union only had nuclear weapons. Now they have very long-range cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, and those can strike the U.S. conventionally. That's one huge difference. Secondly, I think the U.S. Navy is going to be extremely threatened and limited in its actions because, again, of the development of new anti-shipping missiles and new submarine capabilities in Russia. So that's another thing which is short of a full-scale nuclear war, which could be very dramatic. If a number of ships, U.S. Navy ships, would be sunk, which I think is a very real possibility. And even the Air Force is running into trouble because I don't think the Air Force is, has the manpower, the skills, the training, the means to actually deal with a highly defended air defense environment, which is what they would be looking at again. So I think if the war happens and it begins not immediately on a full, you know, nuclear exchange between the two countries, I think there could be some very major developments which the general public here has not been educated at all to prepare for.
Right.
I think that's a major difference. At the end of the day, again, it would be fold or try to negotiate a stop or continue escalating. I will tell you that the nuclear triad in the U.S., as far as I know, is fully functional. It can inflict huge damage on Russia. And if that was the case, yeah, Russia will fight back and it can end up in mutual assured destruction, absolutely.
If it inflicts huge damage on Russia, doesn't that mean huge damage on Europe?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But see, there's the difference with the Cold War. Everything was centered on Europe during the Cold War. That's why the intermediate range issue was so important. It's missiles deployed in Western Europe who can reach Russia, and Russia could not reach in a similar way back into the continental United States. That has fundamentally changed. Now Russia can very much strike any point in the 50 contiguous states. So,
right, and this is something the neocons are still very grumpy about because remember, in 1990, their decision to not take down the government completely, which they could have done, was because they didn't want the nuclear arsenal to fall into the wrong hands. And I don't think they thought the Russians could build back as fast as they have.
Yeah. I think I very much agree with you again. And there was this, and if your point of view is no matter what, by definition, we're the best, the most powerful, the more, most everything, then you don't have to worry too much about it. Because no matter what, you know, eventually we'll kick ass. And that mindset is what allowed Russia to develop these capabilities. And the U.S. has nothing, not even in the pipeline, really.
There are two other questions I want to ask you. Steve Bannon, when he was in the administration for maybe 7 seconds, made a very persuasive case, which I tend to agree with, that we should worry a lot more about China than Russia. And the question is, why the focus on Russia when, if you look at geopolitics, China is a far bigger potential problem for us?
Because Russia is a civilizational challenge, too. The Chinese are not anywhere near. Look at the kind of statements made by Russian senior Russian diplomats. You'll never hear the Chinese saying that so far. China is really, it's an economic danger, but in terms of values, of civilizational and militarily, Russia is far more powerful and far more willing to engage and confront the United States. China hasn't done that yet. And I understand them why. I mean, they're doing the right thing by delaying the confrontation. It's not a criticism, right. But the fact is they're still not up to the capability of actually standing up to the United States overtly.
Right. So I, as you know, I've written a lot for the last 20 years about the money going missing from the federal government, including DOD. And Dr. Mark Skidmore, a year ago, reviewed the sort of the 98 to 2015 DOD documents and found that there was $20 trillion missing from DOD, $1 trillion missing from HUD. And the pushback from the administration was to announce a major audit and make a very big deal about that. What happened as a result of that audit is the auditors found their way earlier this year to the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board and pointed out that if they did a real audit, they would disclose confidential classified projects. And so the board announced that a preliminary policy that said, okay, by an unknown process, an unknown group of people at DOD can classify whatever they want, and it will be completely secret, which is, of course, in violation of the Constitution, all financial management laws. I don't see where they get the authority to do that. They invited comment from the other agencies. HUD basically said, oh, we need that too, not being able to explain why a domestic housing agency would need such powers. The CIA was fully on board, according to their response, and they just went final with that policy, which means that an unknown group of people at the Department of Defense can classify whatever they want, whenever they want, by some unknown process that we can't know. And then the National Security Director can basically waive any SEC requirements of any of the government contractors or defense contractors who participate in those operations or money, which means the entire U.S. economy, whether it's government or private, is basically in Never Neverland accounting. You have no idea what the you know, what the numbers mean. They're you know, the whole thing is now meaningless and completely outside the law, whether the Constitution or the financial management law or the financial disclosure laws. And, you know, I have to tell you, the hardest thing in the world is to run a pot of that much money when you have no law to back you up. You know, you have complete flexibility to do whatever you want. And the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board justified their policy by saying, unless they did what they did, they would have to redact and classify the entire U.S. financial statements.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, but again, isn't it the same thing? Again, it's a dismantling of a system which used to be at the very core of what made the USA so successful.
Right.
It's all short-term fixes, all of them designed to basically, you know, be less transparent, less able to defend your positions or your programs or et cetera in the public arena. I mean, these are all signs of weakness, I think.
Right. Well, basically what you've done with the missing money before 9/11, then the changes in the Patriot Act and the budgeting after 9/11, and now with this, is you've taken the entire U.S. federal budget dark while using the NSA and a variety of other mechanisms with the telecommunications companies to destroy privacy of the citizens. So you've created a complete one-way mirror. But it's really interesting. I read a wonderful piece that I posted from a Swiss money manager who I think really understands what he's doing. And he basically said, look, you know, price discovery is gone. There are no markets. You have to decide what you think has value and meaning, you know, and invest, because savings are precious, but you have to make, in an environment like this where there is no market and there is no real price, you've got to decide what has value and why, and it's a very personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't agree more, but it puts us in Never Never Land. And so, you know, what that says to me is the U.S. system is now completely out of control.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And it's out of control, and it's not, it simply does not have the means, intellectual or otherwise, to adapt and to respond in a viable, you know, purposeful way. It's sort of plugging holes
so
at any cost.
I'm gonna still disagree with you there, which is a great deal of money has been going somewhere, and there's a great deal of hardware flying around in our sky, which clearly has tremendous technological capability. And I don't begin to understand who and what it's all about, you know, but something far weirder is going on here. And the U.S. has been able to pull the rabbit out of the hat many, many times when it shouldn't have been able to. And I don't know why. And as long as I don't know why, I'm not willing to completely agree with you there. But I would say the situation is beyond dangerous, because I think you're right. I think the Russians are not to be underestimated, that they do understand what war is. They, as far as I'm concerned, the Russians won World War II for the Western world. So the situation is very, very dangerous, which is why I'm very curious about what in the world's going to happen in Paris on November 11th when Putin and Trump meet. And I'd like to close by asking you, what in the world do you think is going to happen there?
I don't know. And I just heard, I think yesterday, Trump saying that he might not even meet with Putin. Didn't he just declare that?
That sounds like an election ploy. I wouldn't take him for his word until, you know, we see which way the elections go. Now, if the Republicans...
Let me ask you this. Let's say the Republicans are successful in the elections. Do you think that after that, there would be an environment which would allow Trump to meaningfully negotiate with Russia or not?
Yes, I do.
See, I don't.
I do.
And I hope you're right. And I hope I'm wrong. But I really don't think that there is a basis in the U.S. elites that is interested in finding a long-term solution or not wanting more escalation against Russia. I think it's going to get just worse and worse and worse.
I do, because I've seen Putin get too much help from the West in the past. So I think there somewhere is a segment, I think this is why Trump is president, that, you know, in terms of civilization values, feels a lot more compatible with Russia. I don't think everybody in the American elites is on board for, you know, running the world with robots and transgender. You know, where this is going is transhumanism.
Yeah.
And I don't think all of the Western elites are on board for the end of human civilization.
Do you see anybody in the U.S. elites who would be willing to give up the empire in order for the U.S. to become a normal country again?
I think there are absolutely people in the U.S. elites who share that desire, that they care more about human civilization than they care about empire. You know, because if you look at where I just did a discussion with Farrell on the gender X, I don't know if you've noticed, but you have different states and cities now allowing a gender X on the birth certificate. So you can be male, female, or gender X. And my theory is that if you look at what's involved in rolling out robotics, you can spend 20 years coming up with a new legal system at state and local and federal government and globally to manage robots. But that's very expensive, very difficult, takes a long time. If you want to go really fast in your rollout of robotics, what you should do is re-engineer the human system to one that will incorporate robots, humans, and every gradation in between. And so you have one system, it's for all labor, whether it's biological or mechanical, and that's how you proceed. And you're using human rights and all these different issues to kind of front for it, but that's what you're up to. And I think there are many people in the elites who are looking at where transhumanism is going and saying, and where AI is going to take us and saying, you know, this is basically in fundamental violation of our values. We don't want to go here.
You don't think that our much more fundamental values have already been trampled on and with very little to no reaction? I mean, just think about the value, the idea of being alive. I mean, the right to life. If an, right. if an empire is headed towards nuclear war, which is, unless there's a change of course, that's where we're headed. And almost nobody protests about it. I mean, you see a couple of people, courageous individuals like Paul Craig Roberts or Professor Stephen Cohen, who are warning about that. But most, the vast majority, and certainly in the elites, everybody seems to acquiesce in silence to that.
See,
I think we're willing to give up everything.
I've seen a tremendous amount of people protest, and I've seen them be killed. I've seen them be poisoned. I mean, the covert operations and surveillance designed to harm or destroy people who fight this is enormous. And, you know, I'll never say no one's doing anything because I've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of people be destroyed or died or killed or, you know, smeared or, you know, I think the fight has been much greater than you think. And the media control has been, you know, sufficient to get really smart people to think that the fight hasn't been much greater than it has been. But
if the fight has been that great, where are the results of that fight? I mean, for instance, let's say Congress. Have those people successfully put somebody in Congress?
Well, if you look at the congressmen who've been destroyed or targeted, I mean, you just had the Republican baseball team. You know, if the bodyguards hadn't done a good job, you could have had, you know, 10 or 20 congressmen dead. So I think the danger has been much greater than you think.
The danger of what?
Look at what happened to Bill Richardson or Kurt Weldon. There have been enormous number of politicians who've been targeted and destroyed. I mean, look at what they did to McKinney. So,
yeah, but that was all successful, though. That's what it brings me to my pessimism. They got away with it. They were successful.
Right, you get away with it until the body politic gets smart enough to not get away with it. So I'm an optimist because I don't think you can run a planet with the level of evil and corruption that the Western world is currently being run with.
And so I agree with that very much.
It's a question. This is not about sovereign nations. This is about the people who, for a human future, get together and you know, and push globally. It's going to be a global pushback. It's very interesting. During the 2016 campaign, I live in Memphis, Tennessee, which is the most American of American places. You would see bumper stickers on the cars that said Putin for president.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, why was that? Because Putin was, you know, complaining about pedophilia, and Putin was complaining about GMO food, and Putin was complaining about anything that is antithetical to a human future.
Mm-hmm.
So for people in Memphis, Tennessee to be willing to put a bumper sticker says to me that there's a human impulse. And ultimately, you know, I believe this is a spiritual battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got to be battled out at the level of spirit and consciousness. And then that will translate into politics. And the question is, you know, of 7 billion people, how many need to get killed by nuclear conventional weapons before the human forces emerge victorious? So I don't underestimate the pain that could result from what's happening, but I, for one, see a human future emerging. And if Russia has a strength, it's because that's what they believe in, a human future.
Yes, I agree with that. I very much agree. And I do see it here too, but what I don't see is that resistance, you know, David Rovick sings we're everywhere, and I agree with that. There are people who do see it. But I don't think the elites are capable of reforming themselves anymore. I think the Trump case was really the last real possibility, and it ended up in abject failure. And I don't think after that there's any kind of, you know, change you can believe in, or, you know, a better, different policy or anything happening. I think it's going to ossify itself completely and eventually collapses the way it's going to reform.
Right. I think we need to be individually and on behalf of our families, we need to be prepared for it to go either way.
Yeah. Very true.
Whether it's war or collapse, we need to be prepared. If you look at what Trump and his military team has been up to, you know, I think they're trying to pull back into North America and create Fortress America so that they're prepared for a collapse. I think they're worried about a collapse. So,
yes, but the only way to make Fortress America happen is to give up on the empire, and they're not willing to do that.
Well, they're not willing to look like they're doing that. I'm not sure if that's a real thing or an appearance thing. Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about Lockheed Martin yet, but we'll do that next time. Okay, before we finish, anything else you'd like to add? Any other comments on the election today?
No, all I can say is I hope you're right and something good come out of it. I'll be delighted to admit that I was wrong. But my expectation is exactly
We're willing zero, for it to work out. We're willing for it to work out. Okay, well, can I tell you something, Saker? It's always a pleasure. You know, whenever I come to these discussions, I start writing notes the month before, and I was like, I have to ask Saker this. What will Saker think of that?
You're very kind. Thank you.
It's always such a pleasure. You have a wonderful day.
Same here, and same to you. Thank you so much for having me.